I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to another edition of Left Behind Bars. I'm Noah Rothbaum, the Daily Beast half full editor. Joining me as always is my colleague and co-host, David Weintraub. How are you, Dave?
I'm doing well. Yourself?
I am well. Looking forward to this episode. We have a special guest, Christopher Kimball from Milk Street.
Should be fun.
His signature cocktail, the Shaken Old Fashioned, which we have talked about on Half Full before. Love to hear a little bit more about that drink and some of his other philosophies and ideas about bartending. Without further ado, we will get Chris on the line now. Welcome, Chris. Thank you for joining us today. We appreciate you coming on to Life Behind Bars.
Welcome.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Obviously, Milk Street, you know, has a huge following for the TV show, for your podcasts, for books. And, you know, what I really love about what you do and your colleagues is, you know, it's so much about not just cooking, but also, you know, I think drinking and entertaining really is a big part of that.
It is odd that food is related to drinking and entertaining. Yeah. This isn't just a cooking class here, right?
Thank God. You know, it's the fun part of life.
Yeah, you know, I have to say in my earlier life, which spanned many decades, I think the joy of cooking was not really a part of it. You know, it was the science of cooking or
right.
The techniques of cooking. And then I kind of figured out later in life that, geez, this really ought to be fun. Let's not sweat all the details. This is not like learning Latin in seventh grade, which I still remember how painful that was.
Mm-hmm.
Me too.
Yeah. I mean, I think I got a C. I was not, I could never figure out why anybody would want to learn Latin. Nobody speaks it. So and whatever.
Well, so, I went to it in later life and actually got a PhD in Latin poetry.
So. Oh, well, that shows you have your priorities really sorted.
Yeah. Yeah. And now I'm a drinks writer. So there you go.
Well, drinking and Latin go hand in hand. Yeah.
They're necessary.
But it doesn't mean that I don't think there's not any science to cooking or there's not a method. There is. But, you know, I notice when I travel around the world, people are actually enjoying being in the kitchen. I think American culture has, up until recently, tried to paint cooking as an inconvenience, right? But it should not be an inconvenience. It should be actually something that's, dare I say, fun to do.
I mean, it can be a pleasant ritual, yep. You know? It can be a way of focusing after a hard day, as long as you make it that way. And it's not going to be like that every day, but that should be a goal, I would imagine.
Well, I think part of the problem has been the American definition. I use the term American loosely. Is, you know, of a meal and it's, you know, meat and two veg, or it's, you know, it's a recipe, it's a process. But if you look at the way other people eat around the world, you know, you can just make some rice and do a quick stir fry or, you know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it doesn't have to be a meal the way we think of a meal. It can be very simple. Many cultures, you know, scramble eggs with tomatoes, you know, and some spices, right. And that's it. So I think that's one of the things I finally figured out, brilliant me, is you know, you can have three or four ingredients in 10 minutes. And yeah, that's also fine. You know, stir fried rice is like a 7-minute recipe, right? I think everyone's getting away from the meal as a concept.
For so many people over the last year or so, you know, being at home, you know, cooking has definitely become like a real, you know, escape and, you know, something that they look forward to. And for somebody like yourself who, you know, that's what they do, you know, is it still enjoyable for you, like at the end of the day, after a long day of thinking and writing and talking about food, to go home and make food, or is it lost some of it?
At the end of a long day, the thing that I look forward to is the old fashioned, right? I mean, that's, come on. I mean, it's a glass of wine. I mean, the one of the things people should know is, if you're in the business like I am with a kitchen here, you know, I'm in the office 5 days a week in downtown Boston. You know, most of us don't cook at night during the week because we have all this food, right? So we do takeout from our own kitchen very often. It's not true all the time, but very often it is. Or you've eaten a lot. I might eat 10 or 15 things during the day, right? Mm-hmm. We had tacos yesterday, so we did 5 different kinds of tacos. I had shrimp tacos, I had fish tacos, I had beef tacos, I had pork tacos. I had 4-5 different salsas. But I really do look forward on, you know, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I love Sunday afternoons because that's when I do a lot of cooking. Or Saturday afternoon. So yes, I love it still. And during the week, you know, I'll also throw something together quickly if I'm sick of what I had in the office. So mm-hmm. I never look at cooking as drudgery. I think if you were someone who had to cook 3 meals a day, 7 days a week, you know, go back to the 1880s in Fannie Farmer's time, there was a huge movement among women because they were spending, you know, 60, 70 hours a week in a kitchen by the stove. And for them, it was drudgery because that, you know, that's a coal stove because it was hot, you know, so they wanted communal kitchens, right? Where people could cook, and it's an old fashioned, it's an old idea, which keeps coming up, but that's not what we're talking about here. You know, so yeah, I still look forward to it.
When you were talking about the old fashioned, I know, you know, we recently ran a story on Half Full for our House Green column about your signature Manhattan recipe, and you had boldly revealed that you like to shake your Manhattans, right?
Yep.
That is, and I think that probably took a lot of people by surprise, since, you know, most, you know, people make their Manhattans by stirring it with ice. But could you walk us through a little bit about, like, yeah, you know, about why you do it and where
that. Well, it was an old fashioned, actually. It wasn't Manhattan.
Old fashioned.
Similar. But yeah, I mean, there are two reasons. The old, you know, the old rule is drink it fast and drink it cold, right? And I just don't understand people who sit there with a napkin around their old fashioned glass for half an hour as the ice slowly melts and dilutes the alcohol. So I drink mine fast. And so I want it cold. I don't want it, you know, warm.
Mm-hmm.
And shaking obviously chills it down fast. And also the theory is, as you guys know, you know, if the proof is over 85, you end up losing a lot of the other flavors. It's too hot. And so a little bit of dilution is great. I don't want to wait 10 minutes, you know, for the ice to melt. I want it to be perfect when I get that first sip. I don't want to wait. So I want it cold. And I want enough dilution so I'm not just tasting alcohol. I can taste everything else in the bourbon and the rye and the bitters and everything else. So I do want a little bit of dilution. I mean, I can also stir it, you know, with ice cubes as well. But I find a quick shake. It's like 10 shakes. It's not 30 or 40.
I stir mine, but I always crack a couple of the ice cubes, which gets you in the same place.
Yeah.
Much. So I put in like 2 whole ice cubes and 2 that I've whacked with my bar spoon, and then you just stir it up. Cracked ice gets you a very cold drink because of the surface area.
The problem with cocktails is, or not the problem, but a slight variation makes a huge difference.
Oh yeah,
right.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, if you make an old fashioned with bourbon and no rye in it, it just doesn't have that spicy, you know, counterpoint to any sweetness. Or if you use the wrong bourbon. I mean, it is one of those things that is, if you're persnickety, and I'm definitely persnickety, it's the perfect thing for persnickety people.
There are endless ways to obsess about your cocktails. You know, some people obsess about having a huge block of ice in there, and they want just one block of ice that's perfectly crystal clear. And I look at them like, you know, they've landed from Venus or something. But, you know...
I don't get that huge black ice thing because there's so many things wrong with it. First of all, I like the sound of ice. Mm-hmm. And I use fairly large cubes, but there's three or four in an old fashioned glass. And I like the way physically drinking it. If you just have one cube, there's something deeply unsatisfying because the cube's not moving around in the glass. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it chills it the same way.
Oh, no.
As well. It's too warm. So I, you know, and I've had fights, you know, in New York. I won't mention where, but you know, they hand me this drink with this humongous thing of ice. I'm going like, well, could I just get, you know, like ice cubes? Oh, I'm sorry, we don't have ice cubes. Well, yeah. What do you? Isn't this a bar? I mean, what?
People take their ice programs very seriously, and you know, the world of cocktails, I guess, is a big tent, and I'm happy to drink with such people and count some of them as dear friends, but. I'm never going to do it that seriously. It's just not in me. And like you, Chris, I drink my cocktails very quickly because I like them cold.
Well, I think there actually are, you know, there's a lot of ways you can divide, you know, the human population. Yeah. But I think for people who drink their cocktails cold and fast, that's one group.
Yeah.
And then there's everybody else. But I think that's, there's that one group. I just... You know, my father-in-law, whom I adore, he will spend 45 minutes drinking his cocktail. And I'm just going like, my God, you know, it's just water. It's flavored water by the time you get to the end of this process. And, you know, I guess the good thing is he has enough self-control. You know, it mm-hmm. shows he can smoke 2 cigarettes a day or something. I don't know, whatever the deal
is. Right.
not me. I was a 2-pack-a-day person in college. But I want it when it's ideal. I don't want it. You know, past its whatever mm-hmm. point of perfection.
As a longtime, you know, fan of the old fashioned, has it surprised you that it's become so popular again? That, you know, it seems like it's everywhere, and there are all types of crazy permutations with, you know, all types of spirits and ingredients.
Oh, like the ones with bacon and, you know, the bacon.
Yeah.
No thanks. You know, I don't, America has this obsession. I think other cultures are less obsessed. With variations on the theme to personalize everything. Everything's got to be personalized. Like we all have to have our personalized t-shirt, right? And I don't think that works with cocktails. You know, just like, please just don't. I mean, you can be finicky about whether you stir it or shake it, but the fundamental concept, it's called the old fashioned for a reason, right? It's like the first cocktail. Yeah, it was the original cocktail. So it was a good idea. So yeah, you can argue about, do you want to put cherries and do you put is it cherries that have been steeped in cognac or is it the Italian ones or, you know, yeah, you can argue about what kind of bitters and do you use orange bitters or, you know, whatever. Fine. You don't need 150 variations on the old fashioned. I mean, if that's what you like, that's fine, but I don't. I just want the perfect old fashioned.
Right. So I think on Twitter, a bartender was complaining that he saw a Negroni listed on a menu that had neither Campari, sweet vermouth, or gin. So it's just essentially like a 3-ingredient drink. And it was like, that may be delicious, but it's not a Negroni. I mean, that's the problem.
Oh, for 3 is pretty bad. I got it.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I think the problem is like recipes. The problem is once in a while, someone really does come up with something great, you know, mm-hmm. And the same thing with a cocktail. There are, yeah, people have invented great cocktails. I mean, the, you know, the tiki cocktails from post-World War II, some of those actually, you know, sort of entered the lexicon here. But there are just too many variations. Too many people want to put their name on a cocktail. And it's okay, that's fine. I mean, nothing wrong with it. But
I think you're right. It is an American obsession. I'm half Italian, and my family over there, you know, they cook very simple variations on standard recipes that everybody in Italy knows, but they obsess about their ingredients and they make sure that they They know the couple tricks that you need to do this dish right. And, you know, the cooking is delicious, but it's not creative and it's not innovative.
No, if you go to Bologna and have ragu bolognese, there's no argument about what's in it.
No.
You could argue about whether the beef was within 10 miles of your restaurant or 30 miles, or whether the tomatoes were imported or not. But, you know, it's a pretty standard recipe.
And there's a lot of competition, but it's about execution.
Exactly.
It's not about creativity. It's about getting it just right. I mean, you should see my aunt in Trieste making tomato sauce with basil. It's a very complicated process for one of the simplest sauces in the world. You know,
I think that's because in Italy and most places, the egos are not such that it's going to be your bolognese. It's just going to be ragu bolognese, or it's going to be tortellini and brodo, whatever it is. You're not trying to reinvent it. You're trying to just make it well. And you're perfectly happy to be part of a communal experience with other people in the country who are also making it. And you're not trying to stand out as being a unique creative soul in the kitchen, right?
Yeah, but you are trying to stand out as being the person who does it the best.
Absolutely. Yes, that's true. Absolutely.
You know, there is competition, and it's like, your aunt, she's a lovely lady, but I'm sorry, that's not a burro e salvia sauce that she makes. You know?
No, the ultimate thing is you make it better than your mother-in-law, right?
Exactly. I mean, that's really, you know, that's the hard part.
Those are fighting words.
Yeah, but still, I like the fact the culture, people feel more comfortable being part of something than wanting to stand out as being distinctly different. And I think that's so American to want to do that.
I mean, I think we could definitely use a little more of that in bars. And maybe after COVID, I think we're seeing a little more of it also, is, you know, dialing back some of the variations that are there just for the sake of saying, hey, look at me. And, you know, maybe focusing a little more on drinks that please the customer. Let's hope we'll see what happens with that. But it's going to be interesting.
I think there's real pleasure in having the same thing over and over again, but done slightly differently because of the skill of the person doing it. So if you're comparing to the last 50 times you had an old fashioned, I find great pleasure in that because you get more nuanced and you understand the drink better, right? If someone's using Peychaud, you know, bitters, which I can't stand, you know, then it's still an old fashioned, but it's a very different experience. And I like that because you're going back. It's like singing the same song. I'm a huge Deadhead, so, like, you know, I listen to those songs over and over again, or I play them.
Right.
Most other people play them. Well, every time it's played, it's the same song, but it's not, right?
It's one Sugar Magnolia or it's another one, but, you know, it's different all through the middle.
Well, that was the whole concept of the Dead. We're going to play the same song every night differently, right? And that was such a brilliant concept, is it's the same repertoire, more or less, but a totally different performance. And that's the same with the cocktail, right? It's the same song, but it's a different performance.
What may I ask is your problem with the Peychaud's bitters? Is it the flavor or?
I can't stand the flavor. I think it's too, it's not bitters. It feels too strong. It's too floral or weird. And I think it really upsets trying to taste the rye. I like rye in my old fashions, you know, or the bourbon. I think it just doesn't work. I think really good bitters, there's some bitters out of London, a friend of mine sent me recently, they're great. It's there as a foundational support for the drink, but I think the Peychaud's is just in left field. It doesn't really, it's not subtle enough and doesn't, I don't know. It has too much of its own personality, I think. But
I like to use it with brandy mostly. I think it works very well with that.
But as in a brandy old fashioned like they have in the Midwest.
Also with scotch. It's very weird. You try a Scotch old fashioned. I know it sounds strange, but it can be very pleasant. But their Peychaud's really work.
I don't think I'm going to do a Scotch old fashioned. I'm sorry. I'm at an age. I don't have enough years left to try a Scotch old fashioned. If I was 30, I might try it because I could get over it by the time I'm 40. But I don't. I might not have enough recovery time.
It can, you know, be a profound shaking of the worldview. That's for sure. But
yeah, it depends whether a profound shaking of my worldview is something actually I want to put on my to-do list. I don't know.
Yeah. No problem. Probably not. You know, I agree. You do reach a certain point, and you know, you've had enough shaking.
Well, I mean, I still travel, or hopefully start again next month. I still travel the world, and I'm open to lots of new experiences and stuff. But I think once you've arrived at happiness with something, I think, you know, you got to have some things that just don't change in life, and that's my old fashioned. So I'm not gonna start playing with that. I mean, if it was a new drink someone made, that's a different thing. But there have to be some things that are pillars of sameness.
Well, I won't suggest the Holland Gin old fashioned then, because that would be just too crazy.
Please don't.
It's very, you know, a very old American drink.
And wait, is it called an old fashioned, or is it called something else?
Well, it's an old fashioned Holland Gin cocktail. It goes back to the, you know, when they first started calling things old fashions, and that brings you back to the gin cocktail, which was the original American cocktail. And because we drank Holland gin, not London gin, in the East Coast here.
And that's more like whiskey anyway. I mean, the Geneva.
Yeah, it's very, but it's more like, you know, it's more like a malt whiskey, like a lightly flavored malt whiskey. But it can be a really good drink, I have to say.
Well, I think a fairly large percentage of the population of London in the 1880s was starting the day with gin. So,
yeah, they were.
It wasn't too, very frankly, good gin, but it was the alcohol of choice, right?
I've got an interview with a bartender from about 1860 in Brooklyn, and he's telling the reporter that he serves as many cocktails at 8 a.m. as he does at 8 p.m.
Years ago, I was in London, and I was getting a tour for some reason of something or other. Anyway. And he mentioned, we were at Seven Dials area. And he said, yeah, if you were here in the 1880s, by 8 a.m, you know, half the people would be drunk already. You know, Fannie Farmer, the Boston Cooking School cookbook, the Boston Cooking School was started in large part to combat the effects of alcoholism and bad nutrition. So it was also true here in Boston.
Well, yeah, I mean, Boston had a reputation too, for sure.
Well, it still does. It's just it's much less exciting, man.
Yeah.
Do you have a lot of travel plans for this summer or for the fall coming up? Or?
Yeah, my wife's trying to get rid of me. I got to go. She produces our TV show, so I have to go to L.A. in June. I have to go to Savannah to Back in the Day Bakery, Cheryl Day. And then I'm going actually Crete in September.
Wow.
There's a wonderful cook there. I just adore Mariana, and she wrote a great book called Aegean. And I'm going there. I just can't wait. Her father still has a small boat. He's a fisherman on a small boat, his own boat. We're going to go out with him. And it just sounds.
Oh, that sounds great.
Yeah. I mean, well, let's go up in the hills and, you know, grill some food and have dinner, you know, kind of thing. So it sounds good.
That's amazing. And that will be for the TV show or for the.
That's the secret, is if I say it's for TV show, I can get the company to pay for it. And then it's a legitimate expense.
You know, that's just organizing your life in an intelligent way where your work is also fun.
Well, I have to say, although no one cares and I get no sympathy, but if you travel, I mean, it is a long, you are working. Oh, yeah. But you know what? I think I can deal with it. It's just fine. I'll suffer through.
Do you have a old-fashioned travel kit that you take with you, like to different places?
I drink what's local. So, you know, when I was in Mexico City or Oaxaca, it would be mezcal shots constantly. So
pretty much. Oh, there's your breakfast run.
Right.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's used as a very convivial, you know, welcome to my home kind of thing. So you get a lot of it, you know. I mean, you end up around a table with a family going through an entire bottle of this stuff, you know, so it's not a one-shot experience, put it that way.
We had earthenware pitchers full of it on the table while the sisters who ran the palenque I was at were cooking one of their semi-wild pigs for us, mole, last time I was down there.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah,
it was pretty amazing. Maybe one of the best meals I've ever had.
Yeah, it's funny how you end up in the least likely situation to have the best food in your life.
Mm-hmm.
It's true.
All the ingredients in the mole were grown on their property. You know, it was amazing. It was
mole's misunderstood a lot. Mm-hmm. It's just a sauce.
Yeah,
you know, like a yellow mole is essentially cornmeal and some other things. It's very different. They're all very different. And yeah, but yeah. I like the idea of, you know, nuts in it and the idea of sugar there just to balance other ingredients and the depth of it. And it's a really good mole is phenomenal.
These ladies were extremely good at what they did, you know.
Well, going back to our earlier conversation, that's yeah, because exactly. They've been doing that same mole for 30 years.
Yep. Yep. And the pig was its brothers and sisters were penned up in the yard, and they were big and mean and really like semi-feral. And boy, that was some gamey pork, but you know, in a good way.
You know, here in the States, usually I used to raise pigs, you know, they'd be 180 to 200 pounds. But when you get a 300 pound pig, that's a different thing entirely.
Those are estimable animals. You look at them and you go, I really don't want to wrestle with this guy.
Well, it's all those movies, you know, there's the sort of spy movies where the guy gets fed to the pig at the end, right? I mean,
yeah, that's right. You could see why. They're not nice.
It's sort of a Hannibal Lecter moment.
Yeah.
Eat or be eaten.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's nose to tail, but it's your nose.
As long as it's the pig's tail, you know, we'll call it a match.
Thank you for coming on, like Behind Bars. Safe travels. We'll look out for the segments on Milk Street, the TV show, and also in your magazine and the book. Hopefully we'll meet for shaking old fashions at some point on the road.
Well, you'll stir, I'll shake. Yeah.
I'm willing to try the shake. I'm willing to try it. Yeah.
You don't have to. That's fine. I'll do it my way. You do it yours. That's the whole point.
It's like the Deadhead School of Mixology. We'll each do it our own way.
Maybe that's it. The deadhead bartender's guide. There'd be no recipes though.
No, you just kind of, you know, improvise as you go along.
Yeah, right, exactly.
One should.
That's what Jerry would do.
Be a 1,000 page book with one recipe, but and no directions. But
and just a lot of drawings. And, you
know, yeah. Awesome.
All right, guys. Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you so much.
All right. Take care.
Cheers.
Dave and I encourage you to drink responsibly, always.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.